This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As the events of the day swirl around us, Iraq, Korea, terrorism, UN, words spoken, unspoken, actions taken, not taken, it can all appear a chaotic whirl. But when the dust clears and time takes its course, the people, places, and events start to fall into a pattern that we call history. From our perspective, it's hard to see how things will go in the future, but in retrospect, it sometimes all looks inevitable. Given its advantages in size, economic power, and the moral high ground, the North had to win the Civil War, right? But what if Lincoln had been assassinated 3 years earlier? Chance, whims, the weather, changes in the fates of individuals might have tipped history in different directions on many different occasions. It didn't have to turn out this way. Editor Robert Cowley asked some of the leading historians and chroniclers of our time to think about the question, what if? The result has been a series of books called What If and What If 2. The first looked at military history, the second expanded the discussion. He's now working on a third volume that will concentrate on American history. Robert Cowley joins us now from his home in Sherman, Connecticut. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
What gave you the idea to do this?
I was searching around for a subject for my 10th anniversary issue of the magazine MHQ, the Quarterly Journal of Military History, which I edited. And I started asking historians, friends, what if? And the answers I got were so fascinating that I expanded it into a special section for the anniversary issue, and suddenly the speculations got press all over the world, literally, and we ended up doing these books.
What is the point of the exercise? Some people might say this is, you know, frivolous.
Well, I mean, I know that the historian E.H. Carr once called it an idle parlor game. But I think it's much more than that, because, for one thing, it teaches you what, in a historical confrontation, what was really important. What was the true turning point? It's entertainment. I think history is taught so badly these days that we need to turn it into something that the ordinary person can understand, can appreciate. And if you ask this question, what if, it truly makes history far more interesting.
In your introduction to What If 2, you also suggest that it reinforces the idea that events, people, matter in the story of history.
You know, history's a novel. Look at it that way. People, you know, history isn't just sheer determinism. History is something that's made up of the decisions of hundreds, thousands, millions of people, and or sometimes just one person. And that's what makes it so really fascinating.
Of all the scenarios that have come up for discussion, first with the magazine and two volumes of books, you're now working on the third, is there one that specially intrigues you?
Well, that would be difficult to say, because there are so many. I think of the ways, for instance, which the American Revolution could have been lost again and again. If a British officer who spotted Washington at the Battle of Brandywine and had lifted his rifle...
Colonel Ferguson, who'd invented a very good rifle.
The first repeating rifle. If he'd shot Washington, what would have happened to the Revolution? If a storm hadn't prevented Cornwallis from getting away at Yorktown? I mean, you can go on and on. That's an especially fascinating what if. Or, again, to invoke a military example, if at the Battle of Gravelines, the naval battle, in 1588, the wind had blown in a different direction, favoring the Spanish. You would have had a Spanish victory, and once the Spanish landed in England, as they planned, they would have had a cakewalk to London. I mean, that, and how that would have changed history. I mean, there's the Battle of Salamis. If the Greeks had, the Athenians had lost that, to the Persians, there would have been no glory that was Greece. But you can go on and on this way.
We hope to. Robert Cowley, thanks very much for joining us. Robert Cowley is the founding editor of the Quarterly Journal of Military History, MHQ, and editor of the books What If and What If 2. He's presently working on the third volume. He was speaking with us from his home in Sherman, Connecticut. So speculate with us, you historians, history buffs, those of you just interested in what was. Do you have a what if that's been tantalizing you? Join the conversation. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, Caleb Carr will discuss how the Second World War in Europe might have ended 8 months earlier. Lance Morrow will join us to talk about the year 1948 and its pivotal role in the careers of three politicians, John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, and Lyndon Johnson. But joining us now to talk about Socrates and the foundation of Western philosophy is Victor Davis Hanson, a professor of classics at California State University in Fresno, currently a visiting professor at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, and he's with us from his office in Annapolis. And, Victor, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be back, Neil.
I wanted to ask you, you speculate on what would have happened if a middle-aged hoplite had been killed, one particular one, at the Battle of Delium, an obscure encounter in the Peloponnesian War.
Yes. In November 424, Socrates, who was, as you say, middle-aged, bald, sort of overweight, found himself on a battlefield and found himself losing, part of a losing effort on the part of the Athenians, and was almost killed. The interesting thing about that is Socrates himself never wrote anything. And Plato at the time was probably 4 or 5, and Xenophon was 5 or 6, and those are the two receptacles of so-called Socratic knowledge. So had he died, and he almost was killed, it's not at all sure that any of his thought would have survived in the form that we now know it, because Plato was a little boy, and Xenophon was, and they weren't going to meet him for another 15 years. And if you add to that, there's also the dilemma that, from what we know of Socrates, his character, his moral values, they seem to reside in Plato and Xenophon. But there's one person who didn't share that view, and that was Aristophanes. And the year after that battle, he wrote a wicked caricature of Socrates in the play called The Clouds. And that probably would have been what we know of Socrates and not the Socrates of Plato and Xenophon.
And that particular play is important because Aristophanes casts Socrates as one of the sophists. In fact, Socrates held precisely the opposite view. And this is a philosophical battle that was not resolved then nor now.
No, and that's a very good point. And from what we know about Socrates, his early career was interested mostly in matters of cosmology, and he's up in the clouds in Aristophanes' play. It was only in the last quarter century of his life, from age 45 until he was executed, that he really started to deal in the dilemma of the Peloponnesian War, when he was confined in Athens with these political, ethical, moral concerns of men rather than the clouds. And they survived with Plato and Xenophon, so not only would we not really know about them, but we're not sure that had he died, he would have started to investigate these other issues that were somewhat different than his early career.
It was not only his battle against the sophists and their ideas about moral relativism and his idea of moral absolutes, but another factor of Socrates' life is crucial, you argue, to the foundation of Western philosophy, and that is the manner of his death.
Yes, I think that democracy sort of got a bum rap after Athens, partly because of the historian Thucydides, but partly because it executed in a very unfair way Socrates. So if he had have died at 45 as a champion of democracy on a battlefield democracy against Theban oligarchs, he would have had a very sterling reputation, and so would democracy. But the fact that he was killed on trumped-up charges and killed by democracy sort of blackened that reputation for quite a long time. And if you also add the idea that later on, with the rise of Christianity, when the early church, which didn't have a sophisticated philosophical exegesis in the Gospels, was searching for some type of mind-body duality-involved interpretation, they relied heavily on Plato, the Neoplatonists especially. But yet Plato says in his seventh letter that he was not interested in philosophy at all until he met, around the age of 20, Socrates. He was interested in politics and poetry. So Christianity itself may have been quite altered in its early form.
We have a speculation from one of our emailers, Raymond Bianchi. He suggests in his email, what if St. Paul had not been converted to Christianity? Would Christianity have broken up into cults and sects that way, the way other religions and other cults did? What would have taken Christianity's place? These are the kinds of questions you'd like to explore?
Well, I think it's a good question because it suggests that there's not quite enough in the four Gospels or the other Gospels we know to create an orthodox, all-encompassing religion that Catholicism came into being. And one of the ways that it solved that problem was relying on pagan, pre-existing Platonic thought, which was similar in many ways. And then the other manner was that it had an advocate like St. Paul, who was a pragmatist, who knew how to set up and unify sects into an established bureaucracy. So both of them were very important.
As you look back, when Robert Cowley first asked you to speculate, he mentioned when he was on, what if the Persians had won at Salamis? That was your original.
Yes, it was. And that's an interesting question because from what we know, in 480, democracy had only been alive for about 27 years, and all of Greece to Attica was in Persian control and really a satrapy of the Persian Empire. Italy wasn't really Western yet in the manifestation of the Roman Empire or even the Roman Republic. So they were really the Peloponnese and Corinth, and that was Western civilization. And we know that when the Persians took over Ionia, which had been a very rich intellectual renaissance there with the pre-Socratic philosophers of the 6th century and the lyric poets, the Persian occupation had a very dampening effect on that. So we can imagine that had they taken Athens and won the Battle of Salamis, there wasn't much left of Western culture to keep it alive.
And the rules of this game, there are rules. You can't just have a complete deus ex machina to formulate this speculation. As you looked at the forces gathered for the Battle of Salamis, Greeks should have lost.
They should have lost, and the Greeks themselves were in great disagreement why they won. Herodotus said it had to do with freedom. Thucydides said it had to do with the mistakes the Persians made. Aeschylus suggests that there was a trick or a traitor involved or some type of secret message. So they all couldn't explain the inexplicable, how a little country of 2 million people with a square mileage of not more than 50,000 square miles defeated an empire, 70 million people, and over 1 million square miles.
We're speaking with historian Victor Davis Hanson about the what-ifs of history. When we come back, we'll also hear from writer-historian Caleb Carr and take your calls. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about history and what might have been. Our guest is Victor Davis Hanson, professor of classics at California State University in Fresno, a visiting professor currently at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Are there historical paths not taken that you have wondered about? You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And a few moments, Caleb Carr will join us, and we'll get into more modern history. But Victor Davis Hanson, a question from Cheryl Ernst in Anchorage, Alaska, who writes, why limit the discussion of what if to politics? How about the burning of the library at Alexandria? Imagine where we might be if the tomes of knowledge, hadn't been lost. An idea as simple as the heliocentric view of the solar system could have had interesting implications for Galileo, Copernicus, even Ptolemy.
That's an interesting speculation, except I think in that case, one could make the argument that there were other libraries in Athens and also Pergamum that had duplicate copies. And I think you could also make the argument that what classical literature was lost wasn't really predicated on that fire. There was more a process of the failure to copy volumes rather than to have them all located in one place. But it's something that captures our imagination, the very thought that society's aggregate knowledge is so fragilely positioned in one place, but I don't think that's quite the case.
Let's go to a caller. Tim joins us from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Hi.
Hi.
Area of both interest and study for me has been the Vikings. And I was wondering, and I've often wondered, since the Vikings came to North America far earlier than the ones around Columbus's time, if they had established a long-term community in North America when their technology was about on parity with the Native Americans, if the whole relationship between the Europeans and the Native Americans would have been entirely different.
Well, I think you've kind of explained your own question, the fact that they didn't have marked technological superiority explains why they came in so few numbers, and they didn't have things like crossbows or arquebuses, which, say, Cortez had, so that they didn't really have a sophisticated economy. They didn't have sophisticated naval technology, compasses in the same manner that Spanish and the Portuguese did. So they really didn't have the techniques of shipbuilding, which is going to take another 400 or 500 years with ribbed ships and masted sails and everything. So I'm not sure that given their level of technological and economic development, they could have done much more than they did.
Logistics turns out to play an important part in all of these things,
yes,
doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. Tim, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
Interesting question. And Victor Davis Hanson, I know you've got to run, but we appreciate you taking your time.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be on.
Okay. Victor Davis Hanson, professor of classics at University of Fresno, at California State University of Fresno, now at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, contributor to What If 2, Eminent Historians Imagine What Might Have Been, and his books include The Western Way of War and Carnage and Culture. Joining us now to give another version of history that might have been is novelist and military historian Caleb Carr. He's the author of The Alienist and Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians. He's with us by phone from his home in Cherry Plain, New York, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
How did you approach the question of what if?
I like to approach it really from the central issue of plausibility. I mean, the thing that's really interesting to me about what if is the things that seriously could have been. There's a lot of sort of speculative history that goes on that's not particularly plausible, but when you look at the questions that really are plausible, it's a great way to get people to look at history and understand how much the human influence really does affect history. There's a lot, especially at moments like we're in now, there tends to be a lot of fatalism about history and a feeling that human beings can't really affect the course of events. And when you look at these central moments that we look at in the What If books, you really can see that human beings make an enormous amount of difference.
The human being on whom your essay focuses in this most recent volume is Dwight David Eisenhower, not when he was president of the United States, but when he was a commander-in-chief of Allied forces in Europe.
That's right, and in particular focusing on what has always been a great controversy. Did Eisenhower make the right call when he decided to rein up the Allied forces in the fall of 1944 and proceed with a broad front strategy into Germany, of approach into Germany, rather than letting either the British in the north or the Americans toward the south make a single decisive strike toward Berlin.
And what was it about this moment? Obviously, you suggest that had Patton been unleashed to continue his assault through the southern part of the, he was on the right side of the Allied line at that moment, that he might have been able to prevent the Germans from consolidating on their borders, and that the war might have been shortened in Europe by, what, 8 months?
Yeah, and the thing we really have to remember that's so crucial is what happened during those 8 months. Besides the Allied firebombing of German cities and German civilians and the, you know, various other military activities, there was a large percentage of the destruction and the human destruction that went on in the German death camps occurred during that period of time. A lot of that could have been avoided had we allowed one wing or the other to make the move toward Berlin. And the decision was, as anyone who's familiar with it knows, Ike's decision was political. He didn't want one side or the other, the British or the Americans, to get all the glory of going for the kill. He was very worried about what the British would do if he allowed his own troops to make that strike. I argue in my article that that was a mistake, because it was a mistake to be overly worried about the politics of it, because I don't know that Winston Churchill really had a lot of places to go if he got furious with the United States. What was he going to do after he stopped screaming at us for not letting him grab the glory, his country grab the glory? But it really is important to remember that, you know, what went on in those last 8 months and how close, you know, what we had done in France in the drive through France, what the American army had done in the drive through France was extraordinary. You know, we had finally learned how to cut loose and fight modern mobile mechanized warfare, our own version of Blitzkrieg in reverse against the Germans, their own creation against them. And it could have been employed in Germany. The Germans were in complete disarray in the summer and fall of 44, and they couldn't believe, the German generals themselves couldn't believe that we paused in our approach.
Let's get some questions from callers, 800-989-8255. And Bob joins us on the line from Geneseo in New York.
Yes, a very interesting program. My what-if question has to do with Germany following World War One and the Treaty of Versailles. Chamberlain is always criticized as having appeased Hitler and made the carnage of World War II much worse than it might otherwise have been. But I've always wondered, it seems that with the Marshall Plan, we learned something from history and decided to rebuild and embrace our enemy rather than to grind them into the ground, as Versailles and the reparations and war debts did. My question is, what if there had been a Marshall Plan for Germany instead of the nature of the Versailles Treaty after World War One? By the time Chamberlain was appeasing Hitler, the flames were already blazing out the windows. What if we had embraced Germany differently immediately following World War One? Would World War Two have even would Hitler have been able to rise to power if factories were reopening and there were jobs and there were other things to do? Would people have been so willing to look to some madman scapegoat in order to rebuild Germany?
Caleb Carr, does that hit the reasonability standard?
Absolutely. That's a pretty much perfect example of plausible what if questioning. In fact, the reparations that were demanded of Germany by the Allies after World War One were not only morally questionable, but they were absurdly large and really punitive. I mean, they weren't designed just for justice. They were designed to inflict an enormous amount of punishment on Germany, and did. Had they gone in the direction of the Marshall Plan, and this is something I talk about in the book I just did on terrorism, that you don't, the easiest way to get your enemy to strike at you through really underhanded and awful methods is to inflict that kind of punitive damages on them after a conflict. And what we learned from that, what led directly to the Marshall Plan, what we learned from the Treaty of Versailles and that experience of the Weimar Republic in Germany led directly to the experience of the Marshall Plan. We learned not to do it again.
Isn't this very similar to following the Gulf War, 12 years of draconian sanctions in Iraq that have killed, I think UNICEF's estimate was no less than 500,000 children under the age of 5 and over 1 million people if you consider all the Iraqis killed. You know, we had the Gulf War, which destroyed the infrastructure of a country. Talk about blitzkrieg war. It wasn't just going after Saddam. We destroyed the electrical infrastructure, the water treatment systems, and everything else. And then the sanctions kept them from rebuilding. Have we not cornered Iraq in a similar way?
I was about to say when I say that we learned from the experience after the First World War, we learned as far as the Second World War, as far as the post Second World War era. But then we immediately started doing things like this in the not only in places like Iraq, but during the long conflict with communism. And then finally, in the Iraqi situation, yes, that is true. The embargo on Iraq did create exactly that situation. It was a very foolish policy, very counterproductive and self-defeating policy. The one caveat I would put to that, however, is that in Germany we had the advantage of Hitler and his, you know, ruling party had been destroyed. Saddam was still in place, which I would maintain was the great mistake of the Gulf War, since that basically was what we were fighting to do, was to remove Saddam, and we didn't bother to do it. But either way, the embargo against Iraq was a mistaken and self-defeating policy, which we should have known from the experience of the Marshall Plan would be counterproductive.
Bob,
yeah, I guess if you embrace an enemy, don't you make them a friend rather than, I guess, doing what we did with the Marshall Plan,
particularly in the moment of defeat. It's really hard to get the public to understand that at the moment of defeat, you know, at the moment that you've defeated your enemy, when people really are bitter and have a lust for some kind of vengeance, it takes leaders of tremendous stature to say, no, we are not going to exact vengeance from these people. We are now going to embrace them. And had we
it's interesting. Some people call us a Christian nation, and isn't that what Christ was saying?
Yeah, and it's what every great philosophical leader basically has said, and
The lesson didn't need to be drawn from the Marshall Plan. After the Civil War, there was a great deal of generosity about not pursuing the Confederate leaders as criminals.
Right, there was some generosity, but had Lincoln lived, that's another great what if question. What if Lincoln had lived to fulfill his plan of Reconstruction, which was far more generous than the one that was implemented by Andrew Johnson, simply because Johnson was not a leader of enough strength to stand up to the carpetbaggers and the people who really just wanted to exploit the South.
Interesting question, Pop. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Caleb Carr, the novelist and military historian, the author of The Alienist and Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilizations. And we're talking about the speculative question, what if, counterfactual history. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Sarah, who joins us from Dearborn, Michigan.
Hi. I love the show.
Thank you.
Well, I was wondering if, in all your historians' experience with the question of what if there's anything that stands out in their minds as being absolutely inevitable, something that was so well grounded in the preceding events that no one single event could have prevented it. And I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you, Sarah.
I think, just to proceed with something we've already been talking about because it's easiest. The last caller had posed the question of what if we had been kinder to Germany between the two world wars. I think, you know, there are speculative questions that aren't realistic. Once we got to the year to Hitler's rise and to the years around 38 and 39, the question of, you know, Chamberlain takes a certain amount of a bad rap. Appeasement was the wrong policy, but on the other hand, there's not convincing evidence that Britain, even with the help of the United States, could have crushed the German war machine at that point on its own. So at that point, it's a little bit inevitable that Hitler was going to try his schemes in Europe, if you wanted to nip the Nazi movement in the bud, you really had to go back to the question of how we treated Germany immediately following World War One. So things do reach, the snowball does reach proportions where it simply can't be stopped in almost all of these questions. What you try to do in speculative history or counterfactual history is you try to go back and find the moment at which its course could have been altered, or it could have been destroyed altogether. The snowball could have been destroyed altogether. And really, there's that moment exists in almost anything, and also the moment exists where it can no longer be stopped. That exists as well.
Emailer Jim Casey in Golden, Colorado, approached that question sort of in a different way. Here's one of my favorite what-ifs, he writes. What if Hitler had gotten into art school?
Well, there's
that.
Yeah, I mean, but that's that. I don't mean to laugh in a mocking way. That's a good question, because a huge part of the what if sort of thinking is psychological. You know, I mean, again, it hinges on the critical role of human beings, the individual human beings that they play in history. And what if Hitler had gotten into art school? He would not, you know, he would not have been as frustrated. He would not have been as angry. It very well could have played an enormous part. So, I mean, it's a very valid question.
Here's another email from Tim Gable in Livonia, Michigan. What if Henry Ford had not decided to pay his workers $5 a day? Would the concept of the consumer middle class have been born? Would the overexpansion of the 1920s have happened? Would a working class with less of a stake in the economy have been more ripe for either communism or fascism?
Entirely possible. But what that question does is emphasize again, we think of, particularly economic historians like to think of history in very dry, non-human terms. They believe that, you know, history is a clash of social and economic, particularly economic forces, over which no individual human beings have very much control. People like Henry Ford or J.P. Morgan are excellent examples of how much even economic forces can be controlled by an individual. Henry Ford changed the entire course of, you know, society with, or a large part of society with how he conducted business. J.P. Morgan saved the economic fate of the United States on more than one occasion by using his personal fortune and his personal stock to bail the United States out. I mean, these are all examples of how economic forces are not superhuman.
Novelist and military historian Caleb Carr, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Caleb Carr is the author of The Alienist and Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians. Also a contributor to the book of essays we're talking about, What If 2? Eminent historians imagine what might have been. He was on the phone with us from his home in New York. When we come back, we'll talk about moments of what might have been in modern American political history with Lance Morrow. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about pivotal people, places, and moments in history and the possibilities of what might have been. A lot of you have been sending your suggestions in by email. Here's one we got from Matt DeForest in Wingate, North Carolina. One of the recent what-ifs that interested me recently was the what-if Benedict Arnold's attack on Quebec had succeeded. Imagine a world in which Canada became a 14th state, or 14th, 15th, and 16th states, and he became military governor of Canada. Not only would he have not moved down the path that led to treason, he would not have gotten to meet and marry Peggy Shippen, and thus miss out on the link to Major André. How would the world have looked different if the French population of Canada leaned more towards France during the era of the French Revolution, and we chose them over the British? Would we have found ourselves fighting alongside them against the crowns of Europe? These are the kinds of questions we're exploring, but we want to focus now on a more modern era and this country. Lance Morrow joins us now. Lance is an essayist for Time magazine, a professor at Boston University. He also contributed to the book of essays called What If Two Eminent Historians Imagined What Might Have Been, and he's with us from his office in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've asked everybody else this, but what was it about the question, what if, that intrigued you?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful question. I mean, you can only take it so far, I think, because you go down different corridors of what if, and pretty soon you lose your way. But it's a fascinating question to play with. What if that bullet that Hinckley shot at Reagan had been an eighth of an inch? I think it was deflected by his rib or something. And what if that had found its way to his heart? What if Churchill in 1932 had been hit by that, had been killed rather by that car that hit him on Fifth Avenue when he was on a lecture tour in the United States? One can build a whole case on the around the idea that the world might be quite a different place if that car had hit him a little harder, and so on.
Well, you chose the year 1948,
yeah,
and a pivotal moment in the careers of three politicians, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yes, I was. 1948 interests me a lot because it brought together a tremendous amount of history in an unusual concentration. In Lyndon Johnson's case, he had been in the House for a number of years, and he was in a race now against Coke Stevenson, the Republican, or rather the Democrat, the conservative, and he, if Johnson had lost that race to Coke Stevenson, he would have probably, and he said he would have been out of politics. He would have gone to running his radio stations in Texas or being a corporate lobbyist in Washington.
And that was the election after which Johnson became known as Landslide Lyndon.
Landslide Lyndon, yeah.
Both sides were stealing votes left and right. He may have stolen more.
Yeah, he was... that it's not quite clear exactly how many Coke Stevenson got, but Johnson was getting a lot from South Texas, from Duval County and Jim Wells County, and from a boss down there named George Parr.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of bidding back and forth, saying, well, how many more do you need? Well, I need 100 more, I need 200 more, and so on. And they were basically voting, illegally voting the Mexican workers and just handing out vouchers for them to vote. So that was an absolutely critical moment in Lyndon Johnson's career, obviously, because had he not won, he would not have gone on to his very rapid rise as the Senate Democratic leader, then eventually the majority leader, and on to the vice presidency in 1961 and the presidency in 63 after Kennedy was shot.
Obvious great questions of what would have happened if he had not been there to enact his civil rights legislation conduct the war in Vietnam the way he did.
Exactly. So it would cut all sorts of ways. But the trio that I talk about, Kennedy, Nixon, and Johnson, starting in 1961 and going through the resignation of Nixon in August of 1974, those three, each in his way, extremely peculiar characters with different psychological coloration and so on, but they had their personalities and so on had a tremendous effect upon this intense period of American history. And all three of them in 1948 were in at a critical turning point in their careers. And 48 also was exactly the moment when the baby boomers were sort of in the cradle, and then George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and so on were in the nursery. And I was interested in the trajectory from 1948 through the end of the Nixon administration, the resignation in 74, and in the role not chance exactly, but in some part it was chance, but the very peculiar circumstances that got them through that moment and launched on their careers. It was in It was in August of 1948 that, just exactly at the moment, by the way, that Coke Stevenson and Lyndon Johnson were locked in their runoff battle and the counting controversies and so on in Texas. It was at exactly that moment, in August of 48, that a young, extremely ambitious congressman from Whittier, California, named Richard Nixon, met a rather dumpy-looking senior editor from Time magazine named Whitaker Chambers, who told them him the story of a guy he claimed was in the Communist Party with him in the 30s named Alger Hiss, who was then the president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and a very highly placed. He had been in the State Department and so on, and was a very important figure in the American diplomacy and so on, and said that he was communist. And Nixon ran with that.
And you write, Nixon came in a matter of weeks, a familiar national figure, jowly, shrewd, earnest in that darkling way that would become famous later. I love that phrase.
Okay.
Let's go some callers. Joining us now is Brad, who's on the line from Burnsville, Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I had a couple of what ifs, and they're kind of Kennedy-related. One, what if PT-109 would have gone down with no survivors? And two, what if the B-24 that blew up over England carrying Joseph Kennedy Jr. had not blown up?
That's great. That's very interesting. There are all these rather death-haunted, these rather macabre questions about the Kennedy family. And what if Bobby Kennedy had not been shot in the Ambassador Hotel in June of 68? Could he have gotten the nomination from Hubert Humphrey? Could he have gone on? Could he have beaten Nixon? And how would history have been different as a result of that? I'm not sure he could have gotten the nomination from Humphrey, but because Johnson was behind Humphrey. But I think that's a very interesting question about, particularly about both in both instances, but the Joe Kennedy, if the oldest son had lived, and if his father had stage managed and pushed him forward as the heir apparent and so on, what would have happened then?
Mm-hmm. Brad, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
In the headlines today from NPR News, the world is reacting to Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation to the UN. France is still opposed to early military action. Arab countries are skeptical. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from France. And Senate Democrats are urging the president to refocus on nuclear threats from North Korea. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol. You can hear those stories later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. At the moment, though, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Lance Morrow is with us, a Time magazine essayist and a professor of history. And let's get back to the calls. And joining us now is Anne, who's in Summit County, Ohio.
Hi. What if, I have four questions, one sentence each. What if Oliver North had not been able to sabotage the rescue of the hostages? What if Ronald Reagan had not eaten mad cow jelly beans? What if Henry Kissinger had been revealed with his gravelly voice as Deep Throat? What if Saddam had not taken the bait of Miss Glaspie and had not gone into Kuwait? And finally, what if Scalia had recused himself because two of his sons were working for Bush's attorneys?
That in the Bush v. Gore decision, I assume.
Right.
Yeah. Is it reasonable, Lance Marr, to look at some of these more recent events and wonder, you know, have we got enough perspective to figure out what if?
Well, I suppose, but I mean that obviously was those were all coming with a political rock in the snowball of every one of those. One of my favorite what ifs is somebody asked Kissinger one time. The way I got the story was he was out at the Bohemian Grove in California, and somebody asked him what he thought was a very shrewd question. He said, "Now, what if Khrushchev had been assassinated and not John Kennedy?" And Kissinger, apparently without missing a beat, said, "You know, in that voice of his, which I won't attempt, he said, well, I am quite certain that Aristotle Onassis would not have married Mrs. Khrushchev.
Let's go for the question from Catlin in Tampa Bay, Florida.
Yeah, hi. My original question was about John F. Kennedy, but I guess it's been answered. Can I ask a question about the Civil War?
Sure.
My question is, what if the Union Army had not defeated the Confederate? Would we be two separate countries today?
That's interesting. Lance Morrow, I think the first book of counterfactual history I was ever aware of or I read when I was a kid was McKinley Cantor's book, If the South Had Won the Civil War.
Oh, I never read that. Yeah, I remember it, but I've never read it.
Well, his conclusion was that pretty much after a period of separation, things would have turned out pretty much the way they did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that the South would have rejoined the Union. And
what about the possibility that there might have been four or five countries? In other words, that the West would have been a separate thing and that the South would have been a separate thing, and or maybe three or four countries. I just don't know. That does sound plausible, though, what Cantor said, that they eventually might have negotiated their way back together.
Well, certainly the outcome militarily could have happened, Catlin. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I find it interesting because I believe that the South, they didn't have enough material and army. By the end of the Civil War, if you read more information from 1864 to right before the war ended, the South was down to their last hope. I mean, I know that the South had gone to like asking the African Americans to fight for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this just. I was just wondering.
Well, I've had the advantage of reading the essay that John McPherson, the famous Civil War historian, wrote in What If Number One, and his speculation on how the South might have won the Civil War focused on Special Orders 191 and the Battle of Antietam. If General McClellan had not been handed Lee's battle plan, he would not have forced the Battle of Antietam, and we might have gone on to other things. So anyway, it would have been a much earlier point in the war. But thanks very much.
Yep, thank you.
Okay, we're going to one final email we wanted to suggest. What if there were no Beatles, writes Eli Gelber. The Beatles shaped a generation. They also shaped the world we live in. Would we still be trapped in the button-down black-and-white world of the 1950s if the mop-tops never rocked the world? So Lance Morrow, I'm not sure there's an answer to that one, but thanks very much for joining us.
Quite welcome.
Lance Morrow is an essayist for Time magazine and a professor at Boston University. He was a contributor to a book of essays called What If Two Eminent Historians Imagine What Might Have Been, and he was speaking with us from his offices in Boston, Massachusetts. Before we go, we want to say goodbye and good luck to Cece Matope Fadope, our loyal producer here on Talk of the Nation for many years. She's off for a year's work in Africa, looking at the question of how AIDS is covered there in the media. She'll have a great time. She'll do a great job. We'll welcome her back. Cece, bon voyage. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.